It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, religious minority groups have been under attack by the militant group ISIS. Our guest tells the often unknown story of these faith groups and the dangers they face in the region.
First, we're getting the latest on sexual assault and rape allegations against comedian Bill Cosby. NBC just announced it will scrap a sitcom deal it had with Cosby. And this morning, Netflix announced that they will cut the comedy special starring Cosby that was set to be released later this month.
Media outlets are reacting to allegations of sexual assault against Cosby. These allegations were brought back into national consciousness by a viral comedy bit calling Cosby a rapist in October. Since then, more women have come forward accusing the well-known comedian of drugging and then sexually assaulting them.
The latest woman to accuse Cosby of sexual misconduct is Janice Dickinson, a former model and reality TV star. She claims that he drugged her and sexually assaulted her in 1982.
Robin Abkarian is with us to talk about these allegations and why it's taken so long for people to take them seriously. She's a columnist for the Los Angeles Times. Robin, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much.
Well, let's start with a clip of Bill Cosby from a routine that he did. It came out in 1969. It's been dug up in the more recent context. He's talking about Spanish Fly. Let's give a listen.
It always happens when you're 13. Only when you're 13 on up to, like, when you get married. Guys stand around and talk about Spanish Fly, and it never starts with one of the guys on the corner. It's always some strange 13-year-old that says, you know what? You know anything about Spanish Fly? No, tell me about it. Well, there's this girl, Crazy Mary. You put some in her drink, man. She... Yeah, Spanish, oh, yeah, that's really groovy, man. Spanish Fly is groovy, yeah, boy. From then on, man, anytime you see a girl, well, she has no Spanish Fly, boy. Go to a party, see five girls standing alone. Boy, if I had a whole jug of Spanish Fly, I'd light that corner up over there.
So, very uncomfortable, Robin, given the current context. Are people, as we hear this, looking back and reevaluating the career and what we knew, thought we knew about Bill Cosby?
Well, I think so. I mean, certainly there's nothing super funny about that clip in light of the latest allegations against him. And to be honest, the fallout on his career, as you've just reported, I think that he's lived a very charmed life I don't think it's an exaggeration to say he's an American entertainment icon. He really has been. And so just the constant drip in the last week of these allegations and women coming forward and putting their names to these charges, I think has suddenly sort of hit a tipping point for him. And, you know, we're socially also at a point, I think, where people are more amenable to hearing women's stories, even if they are decades old. And I think it's all coming back to really be harmful for his career and his reputation.
Why are we at this tipping point? Some of the women involved have made these accusations for quite some time now. Why are they being taken seriously and enough to where other women are coming forward now?
Well, yes, certainly. I think Janice Dickinson said she was inspired by other people to come forward. I think Barbara Bowman, who spoke, who wrote a piece in the Washington Post and who also spoke to CNN, said she was inspired by a woman named Andrea Costand, who sued Bill Cosby for drugging and sexually assaulting her in 2004. And her case was actually settled out of court in 2006. You know, you can say it's sort of random people over the years, but I think what people are starting to look at is there's a 40-year pattern here of allegations of sexual impropriety. And I think with Twitter and the internet and the ability for charges to go viral and that comic routine where the Hannibal Buress, the comedian, joked about Bill Cosby being a rapist, suddenly, you know, it's like a snowball rolling down a hill. And suddenly it's not just these random accusations from random corners, but it becomes something that's big and bad and very difficult for him to deny, I think.
In a very recent piece you wrote about this, you also compare the cases of Gian Gomeshi, a broadcaster in Canada, heard often here on this network, actually, when he was still on Q, and Jimmy Savile, a very disturbing case in England, posthumously discovered that he had abused large numbers of children.
Right.
So what is it? Presumably some people knew what was going on or had ideas what was going on. What makes it so hard for people to pursue this?
Well, I think in the case of Jimmy Savile, his show is called Top of the Pops. He was famous not just for this entertainment program, but for his amazing amount of charity work that he did with children. In retrospect, you know, what better place to meet your victims? And this guy was a pedophile. And there were investigations that were launched, and they were put aside. You know, you have a tremendous amount of money riding on these personalities. These are people who generate immense amounts of money for their corporations. And you also have, I think, the human tendency not to want to believe that this kind of thing is happening. I mean, certainly we saw the terrible scandal with the Catholic Church in the last decade. It's people do not want to believe this stuff of their heroes and their icons. But in fact, these people, these men, have feet of clay, and their fame and their power enable them to sort of insulate themselves from these charges. I mean, Gianco Meschi is a good example of somebody who wasn't quite famous enough to fend it off for a very long time. But in Jimmy Savile and Bill Cosby's case, you've got these guys who are worshipped by people. You know, Bill Cosby is the American dad. He's everybody's uncle. He, you know, stands for fatherhood and what's good and what's right. And it's just really hard for people to wrap their heads around the possibility that in his private life, this guy was a pervert.
Now, Joe on Facebook raises a point. He writes, "So much for innocent until proven guilty, guilty in the court of public opinion. I'm not right. suggesting," Joe says, "that he's innocent or what he did isn't wrong if he did it, just that he's being hung out to dry before he's been given a fair trial. Internet rage is no basis for this." So where do you want to run with that?
Really interesting point. But at this point, what we're talking about is only the court of public opinion, because the statute of limitations on these crimes, if they occurred, has long since lapsed. But that doesn't mean that bad things happened, and it doesn't mean that people can't use their brains and common sense to evaluate how they feel about this. I mean, if you've got numbers of people coming forward over the course of four decades with detailed stories about how they were treated by a person, I think it's fair for people to talk about it, to make their own judgments. Clearly, we see in the case of Netflix, which just dropped a special that was supposed to be on with Cosby after Thanksgiving, and NBC, which just announced this afternoon it's no longer going forward with a revival of a sitcom for him. They're using their common sense, and they're making their best judgment, and they've decided that it's too risky to go forward with him. So nobody's saying, you know, now he gets to go to jail. Of course we have due process. And, you know, if he can't be prosecuted, he can't be prosecuted. But that does not mean that people cannot have strong opinions about what they think happened.
Now, when we're talking about sexual assault of an adult or sexual abuse of a child, there is some built-in disincentive for someone to come forward, for a victim to come forward with accusations. Their lives will be publicly difficult in one way or another. Does it make it even more difficult when the person is in an authority position, a celebrity, somebody beloved that you don't want to believe the worst of?
Of course. I mean, imagining accusing your local parish priest of sexually abusing you. That is the power of the patriarchy right there. Imagine accusing somebody who is beloved by millions of people of abusing you. I mean, it only adds an extraordinary layer, I would think, of reluctance to people wanting to come forward. In the case of Barbara Bowman, whose column in the Washington Post I mentioned, who said she was drugged and raped by Bill Cosby when she was a 17-year-old aspiring actress and he took her under his wing, she said she went to her agent, and her agent, you know, basically refused to believe her. She said later a friend took her to a lawyer. The lawyer laughed her out of his office. We did see in the case of the woman at Temple University who came to an out-of-court settlement with Cosby that the prosecutor in Pittsburgh said he believed that Cosby had done something wrong, but he didn't feel that he could get a jury to agree beyond a reasonable doubt that a crime had occurred. You know, there are different standards in life. There's a criminal standard, and there's certainly the standard in the court of public opinion, and that's a valid standard, too.
One more thought. One of the people making these accusations, I believe it was Barbara Bowman, wrote a piece saying, "Why did it take so long for people to take my accusations seriously? Do we not take women's stories seriously in cases like this?"
Oh, yeah, of course. We don't take women's stories seriously in cases like this, for sure. I mean, there's always the issue of the gold digger. the ulterior motives, the revenge. You know, it's very, I mean, you can see in the comments on news stories in the Cosby case, you know, there's a big contingent of his fans who believe that these women are lying through their teeth, you know, who are trying to gain fame, gain fortune, whatever. But I mean, I would submit to you as a woman that it's the rare creature who would want to put herself out for this kind of scrutiny and embarrassment and yes, shame, for a made up story.
We're talking to Los Angeles Times columnist Robin Abkarian about the sexual assault allegations against Bill Cosby and why people are just now taking them seriously, though some of them have been out there for some time.
What do you think about this news about Bill Cosby? Has it changed your perception of the comedian and sitcom actor? And why do you think these allegations are just getting traction now? Why do you think it's been so difficult for sex abuse victims to speak out, especially against a celebrity or a man in a position of power? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're picking up our discussion with Los Angeles Times columnist Robin Abkarian about the sexual assault allegations against comedian Bill Cosby.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Has this news changed the way you see the actor and comedian? Why do you think it's hard for sexual assault victims to come forward, especially when they're coming out against someone famous, someone respected, in a position of authority? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email talk@WPR.org. We'll go to a caller. We've got Jim on the line in Colfax. Jim, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I seen him, Bill Cosby, just the other night in the La Crosse Center in Wisconsin. Always wished I could seen him. When I looked him up on the internet to see where my seats were and things, I couldn't believe the allegations that were against him because he's a childhood icon. You know, I grew up with his comedy act, and first thing that came to mind is they're after him because he's got all this money and fame, and it's just someone to go after. So I just stand behind it that his comedy act was the cleanest act I've ever seen for comedy. He was not a swear word in the bit, and it was fit for all ages to see, and that's where I'll leave it. I thought he was absolutely fabulous. I hope that they come out false, the allegations.
Jim, thanks for the call. It sounds like at least Jim's initial response is to not believe this and at least to hope that it isn't true and it didn't spoil his ability to enjoy Cosby's show. Do you think that's going to be a common response, especially from fans, Robin?
You know, I think that raises a really interesting point, and that is whether people can and or should separate a celebrity's private behavior from his professional behavior. And I think, you know, for many people, it's going to be very difficult to enjoy Bill Cosby's clean brand of humor going forward, although, you know, clearly he's in the twilight of his career. He's 77 years old. But other people, I think, will be able to say, look, I don't know what the facts are. I don't know what happened. It seems kind of weird to me that these women are coming forward all these decades later. And I love the guy, and I want to keep enjoying his very clean brand of humor. I think that's an entirely human reaction, actually.
Jim, thanks a lot for the call. Before we go back to our callers, Robin, looking at how things have changed or maybe haven't changed, I don't know, over time, Do you think we're getting to a place where women are feeling more comfortable is probably a strong word, but safer, I guess, coming forward with accusations like these, that there's a chance they might be taken seriously now more than they used to be?
Yeah, you know, I do think that. And I think, too, you know, the internet, not to put too fine a point on the internet, but the internet and Twitter have connected people in a way more intimately, you know, than other forms of communication in the past. And so I think, you know, the fact that people can get into the conversation in real time to talk about what they think, to zing, you know, information around, whether it's clips of videos or whatever, I think really does help people realize, particularly women who believe that they have been wronged in terms of being disbelieved when they bring sexual assault allegations into the public. I think it does help them, and I think it does embolden them, and I think there is a different kind of conversation happening thanks to the internet and thanks to Twitter about these issues now.
Is there a flip side, a risk of backlash when you go out because of that ready communication online?
Yeah, of course there is. I mean, people jumped. I mean, this is not related to sexual assault, but I remember when the Boston Marathon bombings happened and, you know, people on Reddit thought they'd solved the case. And, you know, it turned out that these poor people who had nothing to do with anything except they were wearing backpacks at the wrong place were implicated in this, you know, heinous crime. So, yeah, of course, there's totally a downside to social media jumping on the bandwagon. But I do think on balance, in a case like this, it's been really positive for women to show that, you know, if they, you know, terrible things have happened to them and they've buried them for years and clearly it's affected their lives, they can come forward and get some degree, at least, you know, a validation, if not, you know, a criminal justice relief.
I want to get back to our callers now. We've got Mary on the line in Racine. Mary, hi.
Yes. When I was in my early 20s, this kind of thing happened to me. I was raped, and I've been married for over 25 years, and I never said anything to my husband or anybody else. That doesn't make it any less true because I waited so long before I told somebody. And then I finally got old enough where I had the courage and I knew myself and liked myself enough as a person where I could talk about it openly with people. So I do believe the women, even though there has been a long delay before they spoke out.
Mary, I'm so sorry this happened to you, and forgive me for asking, yeah. But what do you think at the time and for many years kept you from coming forward?
Oh, I was just ashamed. I didn't even want to think about it myself. I just, it was just a terrifying situation. I was so afraid, and it just damaged me, and I just could never talk about it. And then one day I talked about it to one girl at work, and since then that kind of helped me to open up, and I told my husband, and he couldn't believe it. He didn't know that about me.
Mary.
But it affects you so deeply that you just lock it away and don't address it.
Mary, thank you so much for sharing your story.
That
Robin,
powerful.
Your thoughts?
Yeah. I think that's extraordinary, and I don't think it's that unusual. I mean, the amount of shame around this kind of assault cannot be overestimated. And I think if you look at the interview that Janice Dickinson did, I think with Entertainment Tonight last night, she talked about how her self-esteem has been, you know, trampled by her allegation that she was raped by Bill Cosby. She talks about how it affected her for many years. It turned her into a different kind of person. I mean, I don't think you can overestimate the terrible effect that rape has on women. And then, of course, there's the stigma attached to it, which makes it even more difficult to deal with.
Mary, again, thanks for sharing that with us. We'll go now to Elle in Milwaukee. Elle, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to comment that stories like this just make me really sad. Like, it's one of those things that you read, you know, someone posts a link on Facebook and you read it and you just are filled with this overwhelming sadness. It reminds me of the situation with the guy who used to do the voice of Elmo, you know, when all those accusations came out. It's like these men have had these careers where they brought so much joy to people, and obviously not to diminish, you know, the experience of the victims if the allegations are true, but it makes me also sad for these men that they don't, not only don't seem to respect their victim, obviously don't respect their victims, but don't seem to respect themselves either, and don't seem to find it important to maintain the integrity of their careers.
Yeah, I mean, I think you get at something really important here, and that is it's tragic. I mean, this is kind of a tragic situation, and as you say, you know, these are entertainers who bring so much joy to so many people, and to discover that they have, you know, secret lives or, you know, potentially criminal pasts or behave, you know, in criminal ways is devastating, because we do put our entertainment icons on a pedestal, and we do expect them to be, you know, the simple version of the selves that they present us on TV and in movies, and it's hard.
Well, thanks a lot for your call. And I hate to even think about this, Robin, but do you think there are probably in the celebrity world other places of respect, people we count on, that there are probably more stories like this that haven't surfaced yet that are going to make us sad and have these victims out there not speaking?
Oh, I think, I mean, given human nature and how, you know, part of the problem is that when people attain a certain degree of celebrity, they also attain a certain degree of insulation against the normal rules of life. And I think we see that over and over again. Celebrities behaving badly. I'm not saying it's always sexual assault. Certainly it's not. But clearly, we live in a world where we afford celebrities a certain kind of treatment and a certain kind of protection from their own behavior. And so I think, Rob, it's inevitable that we are going to see more stories like this down the line.
Robin, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much. I enjoyed it.
We've been speaking with Robin Apkarian. She's a columnist for the Los Angeles Times. She was with us to talk about the sexual assault allegations and the conversation, the nationwide conversation that's come up since these allegations against comedian Bill Cosby.
This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Vicker.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll look ahead to the deer hunting season in Wisconsin and find out what's changed for hunters this time around.
First, it's time for Wisconsin Life. On bike paths, city streets, and even on ice, bicycles seem ubiquitous in Wisconsin. The first bicycling boom hit the state in the late 1860s, and its most public face was a young woman who took the state and the sport by storm. Jesse Gant tells us the story.
There's a remarkable illustration featured in the Daily Milwaukee News of April 16, 1869. It shows a young woman riding a velocipede. Velocipedes were the all-iron and wood frontrunners to today's bicycles. The term comes from the Latin words velox pedis, or swift of foot. Given their tendency for a rough and bumpy ride, they very early on earned the nickname Bone Shakers. Some, however, became quite adept at riding them. The image is an ad for Ida Schuller's upcoming performance at a Milwaukee ice skating rink to show off some of her tricks on the new machine. In the image, Schuller gazes forward. Her right foot perches on the pedal just before pressing down. It is easy to imagine Schuller wheeling right up and out of the page. For 25 to 50 cents, Milwaukeeans could come and watch young Edith Schuller perform. It's the first image known to exist of a bicyclist in Wisconsin.
Many of our citizens have doubtless seen in the hotels or show windows photographs of a beautiful young lady riding a velocipede.
Little is known about Schuller, but in the late 1860s, as a velocipede mania swept Europe and the United States, she became Wisconsin's first and most important early cycling advocate. Throughout the spring of 1869, adoring and boisterous crowds packed indoor velocipede rinks where riders like Schuller performed a variety of stunts. Her shows amazed, dazzled onlookers and helped captivate Milwaukee newspaper reporters for much of the spring.
Her feats give the beholder new ideas of the capacity of the velocipede. She seems to perform with greater perfection, if such a thing were possible, each evening.
That's how the Milwaukee Daily Sentinel described it on April 20th, 1869. Schuller's celebrity grew with her many performances that week. Newspaper accounts made sure to highlight her stellar velocipedestrian skills. The new machine suggested possibilities of freedom and mobility many Wisconsinites were only beginning to fully comprehend. Yet with Schuller's help, Badger State residents were encouraged to think in new ways. Women like Schuller forced new questions, not only about roads and infrastructure, but more general considerations about community, belonging, and even Wisconsin's own sense of self. Just 4 years after the Civil War, women were not yet considered a full and formal part of American politics. Yet in a small way, the velocipede rinks created a new kind of access. Women recognized from the start that the bicycle held out promise for greater mobility and personal freedom. Ida Schuller was one early bicyclist Wisconsinites would do well to remember.
Jesse Gant is the co-author of the book Wheel Fever, How Wisconsin Became a Great Bicycling State.
Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television. For more info, visit wisconsinlife.org.
Although Islam became the dominant faith in the Middle East in the 11th century, other religions existed in the region for millennia, some even before the birth of Christ.
Their numbers dwindle as the faithful die off or become victims of persecution and religious extremism. Their stories have taken on greater urgency as some groups have been attacked by the militant group ISIS. Our next guest was a diplomat serving for nearly 15 years in the Middle East. His new book aims to elevate these lesser-known, in some cases ancient, religions to greater public awareness.
Gerard Russell is a senior associate at the Foreign Policy Center in London and a senior fellow with New America's International Security Program. He's the author of the book Heirs to Forgotten Kingdoms, Journeys into the Disappearing Religions of the Middle East. Gerard, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
Well, let's start with a group that probably a lot of Westerners hadn't heard of until they made headlines when ISIS began attacking them. It's been reported that they may now be facing an attempted genocide by ISIS. Who are the Yazidi?
Well, the Yazidis are people who came into being about 1,000 years ago, but many of their customs go back much, much further in time. So one of the remarkable things that I discovered doing the research for this book was that the handshake, which we take for granted in the Western society, we think of it as a very conventional, mundane thing, actually has its origins in ancient Middle Eastern faiths. One of them, called the cult of Mithras, was very common in ancient Rome, and they used the handshake as a ritual symbol of brotherhood. And so do the Yazidis today. They've kept that tradition, and they've also kept many others, the sacrifice of a bull once a year, a cult of the sun. They pray towards the sun three times a day. And although they believe in an omnipotent God, they have many beings that they believe are between God and us, like angels. One of them is a peacock angel, Malak Ta'us. And because they identify Malak Ta'us with Lucifer, a lot of Muslims accuse them of being devil worshippers. But the truth is that their theology is very intricate, very ancient, and they believe that the devil was redeemed. And that's in some ways something they hold in common with Christians from that area, who believed also that everything could be redeemed. Nothing was condemned to hell. The Yazidis say hell has been abolished.
You say that some Muslims believe that they're devil worshippers, or they worship Satan. Is that, do you think, part of the story here when you look at their persecution happening right now at the hands of ISIS?
Absolutely it is. And it's not the first time. They count 72 persecutions, excluding this one, and excluding the fact that even 7 years ago, they were victims of the world's second worst recorded terrorist attack, when over 700 Yazidis were killed in a single spate of bombings, again, by Islamic fundamentalists. And very sadly, they're much misunderstood. And I'm afraid that there's also a strand in Islam that says we're not going to accept these other religions. They have to convert or die.
Now, this is something you say is relatively new when you look back through the long years of history, that religious plurality used to be something that was much more a part of life in the Middle East. What happened? What changed? And what did it used to be like?
Well, it's always been ups and downs. And it's hard to generalize about Islam as it would be to generalize about Christianity. And I guess humanity doesn't have a great track record of tolerating other religions on the whole. But it's particularly in the last 50, 60 years that if you talk to the Yazidis alive today, they will say that it's, you know, a generational change. People used to eat with them, for example. Muslims used to eat with them 30 years ago, but today, not really. Most Muslims regard them as unclean. And this is, you know, not a universal view at all among Muslims, but it's becoming more and more common. And very sadly, we see that go alongside tension with many other religions, with Christians in Egypt, for example, which has really grown since the 1970s.
And going back to the Yazidi, now this is a group that had been protected in part by the places that they lived in the mountains of Iraq that had protected them. But before the situation we see them in now, what were their lives like?
Well, they've always been poor. They had a lot of independence in the Middle Ages and the late Middle Ages, up till the 19th century, actually. They lived in relatively distant places, far from the cities. And on the whole, most governments weren't bothered about them. I mean, despite the image you may have of Islam as intolerant, the truth is most Muslim rulers weren't that fast, provided that it didn't get in the way of trade and building empire and running a state. So they were largely speaking left alone until, you know, gradually
that stopped being an option for them, partly because the modern state has become so much stronger in the Middle East. And as I say, you know, if you go back to the 50s, the 40s, you'd find a really different attitude from the Iraqis. And if you look around the world of Islam today, you'd find different attitudes, of course. But that really noticeable trend in the last 50 years is the growth of Islamism and, sadly, you know, the decline of tolerance along with it. It's not universal. I don't want to exaggerate. But definitely it is a trend which has, in my view, done a lot to damage the beautiful fabric of the society of the Middle East, which had existed for hundreds and indeed thousands of years. There are, in the book, it catalogues seven religions which have existed and draw on Greek philosophy, on ancient Persian faiths, which draw on the ancient Egyptian language and culture. And all these things which we go to museums and we see them and we think that's wonderful to see, but they're dead long ago, actually they're still alive. And yet people are so much more interested in seeing the physical relics and they could actually encounter the real people. I think the death of these ideas, of these religions, is a tragedy, you know, on a scale with the terrible cultural depredation we're seeing of the Middle East's physical heritage. It's a loss for humanity.
Now, you talk about another religion, one that you call a disappearing religion within Iraq, the Mandaeans. Can you tell us about them?
Yes, the Mandaeans. You know, I was always fascinated by Babylon. When I was a small child, when I was about 6 years old, I read stories about this culture, so old, so unimaginably distant in time, and yet I discovered that it's still alive. The Mandaeans are a people, very few in number, just especially now, I'm afraid. They preserve the language of ancient Babylon, and even some of its magical spells, if you'd believe it, word for word. In the 20th century, the Mandaeans were using a spell, which it was a I'm afraid it was a black magic spell, and it started, sundered is Bel from Babylon, sundered is Nebu from Borsippa. And these are gods of Babylon. Bel, as in Belshazzar, Nebu, as in Nebuchadnezzar. You know, names out of the Bible, but they are still in use in the 20th century. The Mandaeans, however, in the last 10 years, very, very sadly, 90% of those in Iraq have left. They are particularly persecuted because they're so few, they're weak and vulnerable, and a lot of people, even just criminality. You know, a lot of them have been killed for their gold because many of them are gold dealers. And they're picked on, I'm afraid, because, you know, and in many cases, you know, forced to convert. So it's a poor lookout for a faith that has survived, in that case, 1,800 years in its present form and draws on, you know, culture, which is 3,000 years older than that, which takes us right back to the dawn of recorded time.
We're talking about some of the ancient religions of the Middle East, some that our guest calls disappearing. We're talking now with Gerard Russell. He's the author of Heirs to Forgotten Kingdoms.
And you can join the conversation. Do you have questions about these religious minorities, these forgotten religions that exist today in the Middle East? Are you concerned about their future, about the political climate that exists today, which pose a threat to their survival as a faith, as a culture? Get in touch at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email talk@WPR.org.
We're talking with former diplomat Gerard Russell about the disappearing religions of the Middle East and the threats they face today and why he says we should be aware of them.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about his experience researching these religions and what he learned and what their future might look like? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can email talk@WPR.org.
And you are talking about the threats facing these religious minorities. Now, you worked in this region for 15 years in the Middle East. You watched and worshipped with alongside some of the people that you write about. How serious is the threat that you see facing some of the different people that you write about today?
A lot of them feel threatened, and perhaps more importantly, they feel unwanted. You know, because the fact is people have lived with fear in the Middle East for a long time. You know, people have lived through conflicts and wars. But when you feel unwanted is the time when you think, well, look, I don't want to be here for my future, for my children's future. I want to leave. And, you know, it's not just among non-Muslims, Muslims often want to leave as well. It's a tough place, and it's insecure and dangerous. But it's particularly clear that the minority faiths, partly because they do find it easier to get asylum, and partly because they genuinely feel afraid and unwanted, are in much greater numbers turning towards flight and asylum and immigration. And, you know, that's a good solution for the individuals, but for their communities, it's very destructive. I thought it was a wonderful thing living in Cairo, as I did, and learning Arabic, to find that as a Christian, I could worship alongside Egyptian Christians. And it was a link for me into that culture. And I have many Muslim friends, too, I should say, and greatly, you know, respected as a religion. But it was just that, you know, when you are of a faith, there's a special feeling that you have when you are part of a community with others. And to me, as I say, it was a bridge into the Middle East, into a culture that can seem so distant. And I found, as I looked at the history of these faiths, that at every turn, one finds things that bind us together as humanity. And we find that our history, in fact, shows how we are related to each other in ways that we would be surprised by. I mentioned the handshake and how that actually connects us to the Middle East and an obscure Middle Eastern religion. But there are many other examples. One of the amazing ones that I found, and an example, by the way, of how Islam didn't used to be as intolerant as it's being presented now by the Islamic State and others, was this mathematician from the early Middle Ages living in the Islamic Empire, but he was an avowed pagan. He actually wrote an ode to paganism in praise of his religion, which was a bit like the Yazidis, actually. And this man believed that Pythagoras, an ancient Greek mathematician, was a prophet. And so he dedicated his life to studying Pythagoras. And Pythagoras, of course, you may know, is famous for his theory of triangles, for his interest in geometry. And so this man expanded Pythagoras' theorem. The one we read in school is partly the work of Pythagoras. Partly it was the work of this man from a city in southern Turkey who practiced paganism in the Islamic Empire. And I just think what an amazing number of stereotypes that can help to destroy. Because actually the cultures of the Middle East have a great deal more in common historically with the cultures of Europe than we could imagine.
So when you think about moving forward, and you've written this book to raise awareness about some of these disappearing religions, what do you want people to take with them about maybe how to integrate some of these people into their communities if they leave in exile, or how to save them now?
Yes. I mean, there were two things I wanted to write the book for. One was to, as a message really, as addressed to Muslims, which is to say, look at this wonderful heritage which you have in your homeland and which you can help to preserve, and stand firm against the militants and the extremists who want to turn your religion into something that's utterly intolerant, because it will be a terrible mistake and you will lose all this cultural diversity. The other is to us in America and us in Britain to say, look at how cultures of the past and cultures of the Middle East benefited from religious diversity. And so let's treasure it in our own societies. And as these communities, these remarkable communities, slowly make their way into the West, let's welcome them and let's attempt to understand them, because they are very, very hard sometimes to understand. Many of them are secret. The priests and the elders, they know the secrets of the faith, but the people don't. And so it's very hard for them to adjust to a new world where religion is openly discussed. People can convert from one faith to another with great ease. And people don't live in small communities. And that's really tough for these sort of ancient religions, because they really still do live, just as people did 3,000 years ago, in little communities that are pretty static over time. And as I say, practice secrecy, as well as a number of other. I mean, Yazidis cannot explain why they have a taboo on eating lettuce, for example. It's just a strange thing that they have. They don't wear the color blue. They're supposed to grow their mustaches. Many customs, and they've forgotten the reason for them, to be honest, but it's part of who they are. It's part of their cultural fabric. And what would be wonderful is to see it be celebrated, especially since we have it among us. And there are Yazidis living in Nebraska. There are Mandaeans in Massachusetts. There are 200,000 Iraqi Christians living in metropolitan Detroit. So there's a wonderful richness of faiths in America, which I also wanted to bring to people's attention. And finally, if I may say so, I thought some of the ideas that they had were wonderful. And although I have my faith, I'm a Catholic Christian, I was also inspired by encountering these ideas which I'd never thought of before and giving them, serious thought, not just as a sort of piece of anthropology, but as ideas that legitimately we should engage with and think about, and they should make us reflect. So I wanted to put those in as well. Things like the Yazidis and their argument that even the devil can be forgiven, or the Zoroastrians who say if there's evil and sin in the world, it's because of actually an actively evil power, and that the world is a battle between good and evil, and we must choose the side we fight on. And rather wonderfully, by the way, they believe that animals have chosen the sides that they are on as well, so that dogs are creatures of good, and cats, I'm afraid, are creatures of evil. Mm. As a cat lover, I found that difficult to adjust to, but it is there in the Avesta. C.S. Lewis, by the way, when he wrote his Narnia books, was influenced by Zoroastrianism, by this religion in Iran. And he, therefore, the Narnia books are all about animals on the side of good, animals on the side of evil. And they are, of course, a battle between good and evil. And he praised Zoroastrianism. He said it was his favorite pagan religion, as he called it. So again, you see how these religions, although we might think of them as odd, obscure, forgotten, actually play a part in our own culture in ways we probably never imagined.
Now, if you look at some of the people that you follow here, you mentioned Yazidis living in Nebraska. How are they adapting and practicing their religion in America?
Well, they found certain things difficult. They're very conservative. And they said, finding kids kissing at school is something they found difficult to adjust to. On a serious note, actually, it's quite difficult for them just at a cultural level. So it's traditional among Yazidis. It's men who kiss each other. But, I mean, that's taken perhaps in a different way in American society. So that they have to adjust to different cultural practices. And as I say, the great difficulty for them is that they've got massively complex marriage rules, which means they have to they don't just have to marry another Yazidi. They've got to marry somebody from a particular caste. So internet dating is perhaps going to be their savior, because if you've got a few thousand Yazidis in America and a few thousand in Sweden and a few thousand in Germany, well, your chances of finding the right person are pretty small unless you've got the internet. So they're adapting. But one of the things that's still difficult is, as I say, most of them don't know what the religion teaches. In order to learn it, you've really got to go through a kind of initiation, and very few people do it. So that's really tough for them. And in the end, I think they'll have to go for something a bit different as a model. It's not for me to tell them, of course, but I think in the end they will have to sort of be a bit more public with their beliefs and philosophy. It is a wonderful and legitimate philosophy. It's interesting. But at the moment I think it's quite a tough time. And, of course, they look with horror at their families in Iraq and what those families have endured. I was in Iraq in August and visited the Yazidis, and I have to say it was deeply, deeply tragic because, entire communities displaced, living in tents. I was surrounded by a great crush of people, many of them traumatized. There was a woman.
I'm sorry, we have to leave it there. We're out of time, but thank you so much for sharing your book with us today, Gerard.
Thank you very much.
That was Gerard Russell, the author of Heirs to Forgotten Kingdoms.